Welcome to another episode of Perspectives, the Behavioral Health Business Podcast. I'm Morgan Gonzalez, reporter for BHB, and I'll be your host for this episode. In this conversation, I'm chatting with Dr. Diego Garza, Senior Vice President of Strategy for MindPath Health. Dr. Garza and I discussed the DEA's proposed special registration framework and its implications for the behavioral health industry, the timeline for value-based care implementation, how to negotiate with potential payer or health system partners, and so much more. A quick note to say that while the conversation quality is really high, the quality of the audio is a little less so for the first 10 minutes of this episode. It's definitely worth sticking around for all of Dr. Garza's valuable insights, and the audio quality will improve after the first few questions. With all that said, let's jump in. Dr. Diego Garza, I'm so excited to chat with you. You are the Senior Vice President of Strategy for MindPath Health, an outpatient behavioral health organization headquartered in Sacramento, California. Diego, would you like to introduce yourself a little bit further?
Yeah, that works. Thank you, Morgan. First, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm super excited to be here on Perspectives today and get to share a little bit more about what we do at MindPath. For those of you who do not know MindPath Health, we're one of the largest outpatient mental health organizations in the nation. We specialize in psychiatry and psychotherapy. We also do interventional psychiatry, and we have presence in 6 different states. Our whole model is anchored on a patient-centered approach to increase quality of mental health services.
Fantastic. Okay. I know you're passionate about so many behavioral health related things. I'm excited to dig in. Let's start with some recent news that we've been covering over at BHB. So the DEA recently proposed a special registration framework and announced a final rule that gives providers 6 months to treat patients via telehealth. This framework has been paused for review by the new administration, but it very possibly could go through. What was your initial reaction to the announcement?
Thanks for the question, Morgan. Yeah, I think overall, mixed feelings, mixed reaction, right? Mm-hmm. I think everybody's going through the same thought process trying to analyze what the rule is actually intending for us to do. But overall, I think the initial reaction is that the DEA's proposed special registration framework, it's unnecessarily complex. I think it will likely create more barriers to access care for an already very vulnerable patient population.
Perfect. Yep. I have heard that from other folks as well in my coverage. And if it does go through, how would it impact MindPath?
I think, this is going to be operationally complex to enact, but I think there are a few things that we are worried about mostly, right? So to list some of the key concerns that we have, for example, the 50% cap on telehealth for prescribing Schedule II substances, I think the main question that we have here is how are the health outcomes of the population going to change with this versus what's happening right now? Mm-hmm. Other concerns that we have are related to the state-based restrictions. We believe that with how much the practice of telemedicine has evolved, we do not necessarily believe that restricting access this way is in the patient's best interest. Another piece is the mandatory 50-state prescription drug monitoring program check, which without a national system in place, this would likely not be doable or operational in the short term. And the rule mentions that it's something that is a requirement, but it doesn't really give us a pathway for completion. I do believe in terms of MindPath itself, some hybrid companies as ours, and by hybrid, I mean an organization that's offering both in-person and telemedicine services. Some of us are going to be better set up to comply with the regulations, but it will still be very operationally complex, and it will be more complicated to engage patients that otherwise would have been reached through the telemedicine flexibilities that we have observed during the pandemic and that remain in place till this day. I think, Morgan, that if the rule finalizes the way it's drafted, it will significantly handicap clinicians that are already engaged in meaningful treatment for psych conditions. Mm-hmm. And it's going to limit access to mental health care for patients of all ages and all socioeconomic classes who rely on telemedicine to receive the treatment that they need. And don't get me wrong, Morgan, I think we do understand why there is a need for more strict regulation around telemedicine practice. Mm-hmm. But we have to keep in mind that whatever we do or whatever the DEA ends up doing is going to impact actual patients' lives. So we need to reframe the thought process to truly make it a patient-centered approach. We believe that it's important to take a population health approach to understand the consequences of enacting a rule of this nature.
And when you say that some providers are better set up to comply with these regulations than others, who are you really talking about there? Who's going to potentially struggle to comply?
I think the struggle will be, I believe that all of us are going to struggle with enacting this rule, but I think practices that have already enacted a model where there is in-person services are going to be better positioned to comply with this rule versus the practices that are full telemedicine only and that they don't have physical locations where the patients could come get that part of the rule, where a patient can come and kind of check the box of that part of the rule.
And among, you know, some of those mixed messages that you were talking about, I know the ATA is encouraging the Trump administration to reject it initially, citing that it would be difficult to operationalize, which you definitely hit on. If you had to predict what will happen with this special registration framework, do you think this will go through?
I mean, Morgan, I believe right now it is hard to make a prediction on what how this is going to play out in the end. But first of all, I want to say that we do appreciate the American Telemedicine Association efforts to put the patient first, because that's what we are all trying to do here. And as part of my organization, we're willing to support the efforts as opportunities present themselves moving forward, as we have in the past. I think for the field of telemedicine, and especially for mental health, telemedicine has allowed opportunities that didn't exist before for the patients, and we would like to see that continue. But taking it back to the question, I think that for the reasons that we have been discussing already, making it operational is going to be very complicated, and not only for us as clinicians or mental health practices, but also for the DEA and federal government in general. I think this is going to lead to increased costs and administrative burdens that we simply don't face today under the COVID waivers that are extended to the end of 2025. And in an era where we claim to be focusing on quality and decreasing total cost of care, in a way, this rule seems that it's going against those efforts.
That's really interesting. And I know we were talking the other day, I know you sat in on a DEA session in the past. What was that experience like? I'll ask that first. Just what was that like?
Yeah, that was a very interesting experience. We are very appreciative that the DEA took time to invite us to join them in their file process. That's something that we haven't necessarily seen in the past, and it feels like it's a step in the right direction. So the session itself was very productive. We saw a lot of mental health providers and experts talking about the benefits or the downfalls of this rule, of the proposed rule. So it was a very interesting couple of days where we got to hear why or why not this rule should be enacted the way it is.
And how can providers work together and with government bodies to push for change? What are those strategies there?
That's a great question, Morgan. And as an organization, we've been thinking a lot about it. And we think that to the extent that outpatient mental health providers can further organize and advocate for the importance of telemedicine in providing access to less costly and more effective treatment for individuals with mild to moderate mental health conditions, I think the better, right? I think this rule spends a big amount of time discussing the perspectives or potential impacts on hospitals and telemedicine platforms. And in a way, it fails to capture the perspectives of the outpatient mental health industry, which is where the majority of the services are being rendered. I think we have seen the power of people coming together, and I will encourage the other organizations in mental health to keep raising your voice on behalf of the patients, continue participating in media opportunities, write about it, discuss what the impact of this change could be, and what does it mean for patients. I think let's put it all out there and try to continue to drive the conversation in a meaningful way that leads us towards improving the health outcomes of the patients that we're caring for daily.
So we've discussed, you know, what you're seeing as this need for some increased regulation, but the real operational challenges that seem to be inherent in this framework. If you could sketch out what you would like to see, what your ideal situation would be, what would that look like for you, Diego?
I think for us at MindPath, what it would look like, it would look something that it's a model that truly has the patients in the center of the approach. And it's a model where we can clearly say, okay, we should do it this way because we're going to increase engagement, we're going to increase access, we're going to be better positioned to increase quality of the services that we're offering. And that's not to say that we have the secret recipe to make this work, but I think there are things that we should be working towards to engage in more meaningful conversation to get us to that point. I don't believe we're there yet. I believe that some of the, even if you think about it, Morgan, some of the research that this rule is anchored on is not necessarily the most recent data that we have available. We can see now that up to 80% of the population in some studies are requesting access for mental health services via telemedicine. So this is allowing people who otherwise won't get access to care to engage in meaningful treatment and increase the improve the outcomes of the patient population. So I think there's a lot that we could be doing. I think we're moving in the right direction, but there's still more conversations that need to be had.
Well, I'm a little bummed out you just won't just say that you have the secret sauce to exactly what everything should look like. I feel like that would really help me if I could tell people that you've revealed that on this podcast. But
that will be amazing, Maria. I have a ton of ideas, but also I understand that the environment is an environment where there's a lot of stakeholders at play. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people looking, and hopefully all of us are looking to really serve the patient population better. And that's my inner belief. That's what I truly believe at the core of my being. But I understand that the dynamics are complicated and that we are entering into a new era where we are going to have to quickly determine what's best for the patients.
Thank you so much for shedding some light on everything happening there. I know we'll all be looking really closely to see what the future of that framework becomes. But let's turn to reimbursement structures. And one of the perhaps most talked about theoretical parts of mental health care, behavioral health care in the industry, we often talk about value-based care. BHB has a whole event talking about value-based care, but providers largely still operate on a fee-for-service basis. This is something we talk about a lot, but what's the current status of value-based care from where you sit?
Great question, Morgan. And this is something that's very close to me and my efforts and my daily work. I've been helping lead the effort around value-based care for MindPath for several years now. And we have seen kind of an increase and decrease, kind of it comes in and out of conversation, right? So we talk about it and we try to do some things. But the reality, Morgan, is that we still exist in a largely fee-for-service model. And the question here is, how do we begin that transition? If that transition is going to happen, how do we do it, right? And from our perspective, I think it is about time that all of us mental health providers start measuring the appropriate outcomes, approach payers with a set of metrics that you think define value or quality in the space, and then match those against what they think defines value and quality in the space, and truly reach an agreement that where we put the patient's best interest at heart and move from there. I think we're in an era now, Morgan, where we all should be leveraging data analytics. We have to understand our patient population, what drives quality, what drives cost, and how do we work on creating a compelling case that can enable a true partnership with payers. I think the ideal partner that we're all looking for is a partner that's willing to invest in the processes, willing to invest in the data set, willing to spend time analyzing data and driving conclusions on what's best for the patient population in question. And granted, Morgan, that is going to look different per patient population, right? It might look different for my patient population in terms of general psychiatry and psychotherapy when you compare it against a specialized clinic on eating disorders or substance use disorders, right? But still, we got to work towards a standardization in a way that allows us to compare and truly drive meaningful change in the behavioral health arena. I do want to say something that I think a lot of people get caught up on these is you don't have to wait for the perfect data set. Start getting into data analytics. Start understanding a little bit more of your services. How is your clinical population behaving? How are your patients responding to treatment? What data points do you have that inform those in a way that you can then create a compelling story to say, hey, what I'm doing, my interventions are actually creating positive change in my patients. I think a lot of the value-based care environment has been primary care focused, even in behavioral health, or largely driven by primary care. And obviously, primary care is if not the most important leg of this healthcare stool, but it is a very, very important piece, and it has to be participating in those conversations. But what about changing the model to a model that truly speaks about quality in behavioral health for both psychiatry and psychotherapy, and any other lines of services that might be related, call it interventional psychiatry, call it
other specialties like services, right? How do we create true metrics that speak about quality and that can then transition us into a more evolved conversation around value-based care or around alternative payment models that move us away from the fee-for-service model that we most of us currently exist in.
And my next question was going to be how providers and payers can actually institute value-based care reimbursement structures. So under that umbrella, you were talking about folks should start looking at data. What data points are most important to track?
I think as it relates to clinical outcomes, I mean, you can think about it from a procedural perspective, like how well are we doing on engaging patients, but also that's a very important piece of the pie. But the other piece of the pie is like, okay, are my patients actually improving after receiving treatment or after engaging in treatment, right? So think about it from that perspective of like, what shows proof that my interventions are actually making patients better? And that's what I encourage all of us to think about, right? It might look different on your practice than it looks on mine, but we have been heavily focused on measurement-based care, on understanding the trends, on figuring out when to do it, how to do it, how to request information from patients, and how do we use that information that we receive from patients to actually modify treatment pathways to increase or to improve the outcomes, right? So again, there's going to be a set of standardized metrics that some people are going to be telling you or asking you to comply with and call it PHQ-9, call it GAT-7, call it some other ways. But there are kind of standard things that all of the industry is doing. But then think about it one step further, right? Like, how do I prove that the value of my services, and how do I prove that the clinical pool that I have created or that I have formed is actually delivering really good quality of services, right? So think about patient satisfaction, think about provider satisfaction, think about what's happening in the session, what data points are we recording or are we observing during the session, and how we use those to look at our patient population at a broad level and start to draw some conclusions around like, okay, this intervention resulted in X, Y, or Z. What of these three things are actually meaningful in terms of outcomes? And what outcomes are we affecting? Are we improving processes? Are we improving clinical? Are we improving? Do we have to change technology perspectives to ensure more engagement? There's a bunch of different things that we have to be thinking about in the behavioral health space. And the good thing / bad thing is that the behavioral health space is not a space that's highly measured. At least not measured in a standardized way, right? So what quality means for me might be a different meaning for another practice or an organization, but we all have to keep the conversation going and try to arrive to a place where we feel like, hey, when comparing apples to apples, this is how my patients are doing compared to other patients. And I think that's what we should be moving towards.
Are there any, when we're looking at moving from fee-for-service to value-based care, are there any other structures like bundled payments that should be in between steps in your eyes?
I think, Morgan, when you think about the spectrum of value-based care, you think about the spectrum that includes regular pay-for-performance up to capitated arrangements where you are in charge of a specific patient population. And I think there's room to play with the different models, right? If you go back to the theory behind value-based care and all of the items that are part of this spectrum that include risk, shared savings, shared risk, capitated arrangements, pay for performance, all of these different models could potentially play a role. And I'm not necessarily saying the industry is ready to go all the way up to the capitated models, but I'm saying, how do we get there? We are in point A, that's point Z. How do I get from A to C in a very organized fashion that still proves and that proves quality and that creates incentives for clinicians to want to participate in these models, right? So it is important that we try to figure out what works best for the practice based on your current capabilities and try to engage in a conversation that you think are going to be able to be successful in and not necessarily take on more because of the promise of more, because it can get very operationally complex and difficult to enact or implement these and make them operational. So as much as it sounds appealing to pursue more complicated models, I think my encouragement is like, start simple, move towards complicated. So that way your organization can adapt and adopt different practices that take you there.
I think that's like good life advice too. Start simple, move to complicated. If I could ask you to look into your crystal ball one more time. If you could imagine a timeline for when the behavioral health industry moves away from fee for service almost completely, is that a future that you see? And if so, when?
Well, I mean, that's a future that I would like to see, if I'm being honest. I'm not necessarily sure that we're going to accomplish it in the next 5 years, but I do surely hope that we continue to partner with payers and other providers to get us there, right? I think the primary concept around value-based care is based on proving that patients are actually getting better with our interventions. And that's not what fee-for-service is, right? Fee-for-service is just a way of paying for services that are rendered, but it's kind of a one-to-one. I do something today, I get paid tomorrow, whatever the timeline is, but I'm not necessarily looking at how that intervention affected my patient's lives. So I think I will hope that in the next 3 to 4, 5 years, we're going to see a lot of movement in this particular field, and we're going to start getting into arrangements that drive more and more value. But as I mentioned before, Morgan, if I tell you about my particular career and my thought process around value-based care and how it has evolved or not evolved, I can tell you that 4 years ago, we were engaged in more value-based care contracts than we are today. And that's because, multiple reasons, right? The payers have their own sets of reasons to pursue or not pursue value-based care. We have our own sets of reasons to pursue or not pursue value-based care, but it is important that we acknowledge that has fluctuated in terms of availability of value-based care contracts out there. So hoping that the conversation keeps moving in a direction where more and more payers are going to want to engage in this and are going to want to make a difference in patients' lives from a different perspective from what we have historically done.
That's really interesting. And when you are discussing, negotiating with payers, what are the key elements as a provider to bring to the table, to bring to those discussions?
I think, Morgan, I love that question because I don't think we think about it often enough, actually. But as someone who's constantly having conversations with payers and health systems and other large entities around these topics and many other topics, I think that what the payers value is a practice that understands their capabilities, right? I cannot go out into the world and ask for a value-based care contract if I don't even begin to understand what I'm able to produce / able to do with the things that I currently have in place, right? So at MindPath, we created a roadmap a couple of years ago that took us from where we were at that point to a more much data driven organization, right? And that has enabled us to unlock a different set of conversations with payers because now I know a lot more about my patients and I can draw parallels and conclusions around my patient population that you can only know or that you can only get there if you're able to analyze your data, which brings me back to the data analytics perspective, right? Like, how do you become a more data-driven organization? And granted, Morgan, the behavioral health field is very fragmented to this day, right? Even though you keep hearing about practices like ours and a few others that have a large pool of clinicians, the majority of the clinicians are going to exist in practices that have less than 5 providers or solo practices, which, if you think about it, a lot of this data-driven component, it has to be enabled by investing in it, right? It's just not something that's going to happen from one day to another. So that means that you got to have the resources able and available to implement this type of thought process and this type of procedures that get you practice to evolve to the next model. So my advice is that if you're thinking about going to the table, understand your patient population, understand your services, understand your clinical pool, understand everything from how you hire quality clinicians to how you enact daily clinical services and everything in between, right? How are the patients doing after the sessions? What sort of prescription patterns are you seeing? What sort of psychotherapeutic approaches are you seeing? Understand you and your company as much as you can, because that's going to enable more evolved conversations around this topic. Also, we're looking to partner with payers, right? So most of us, I mean, these value-based care contracts are highly anchored on payers doing their part. And I think we have to be open-minded around the needs and wants of the payers, right? Understanding where they are coming from, understanding what they are seeing from their members. They have access to a different data set that we do, right? So trusting that they are looking at their data set and drawing conclusions as we should be doing, then what do they need? What approach serves the purpose best, right? And granted, the purpose or the goal is to improve health outcomes of the patient population overall. But how do we get there? It might look different for different organizations. And that's okay, right? I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all in terms of value-based care. But I think there is opportunity for us to truly understand our capabilities and the patient's needs, and that translated into what the payer is looking at, and then come up to the table and say, hey, this is what we believe we should be doing. Let us discuss about how this matches with your vision and how this matches with your strategic planning for the following years. And how do we become part of it, right? I think be open-minded in the sense that your proposal might not necessarily be exactly what they're looking for, but the ability to tailor your plans and goals and processes and procedures to the partner that you're looking to work with is very, very important, right? Because again, I wish I could tell you, do this and you're going to be successful. The reality is that that's not how it works. And we need to be able to tailor our capabilities and our efforts to comply with the needs of our partners in the industry.
And you mentioned that, I believe you said 4 years ago or so, MindPath was in more value-based care arrangements than you are now. What are MindPath's goals for your value-based care arrangements for the next, you know, few years, 3 to 5 years?
I mean, we are working towards having a greater percentage of contracts anchored on value-based care. We believe that we provide quality services. We believe that we have some of the best clinical talent in the nation. So that has put us in a position where we can go out into the world and enable alternative payment models in a different way than compared to where we were 4 or 5 years ago, right? So I think we have historically done very well in value-based care contracts because we have an ability and a willingness to tailor our metrics, our procedures and processes, and our technology to comply with what's needed. But the reality is that those value-based care contracts at the moment seem to be measuring different things in very similar patient populations. So how do we achieve a little bit more of a standardization in an effort to be able to engage in more contracts is what we're working on right now. And we've been having meaningful conversations and very, very insightful conversations with payers that have helped us shape the way we think about quality and the way we think about portraying that quality into the world to hopefully get us to secure more value-based care contracts in the very near future.
Fantastic. Okay, thanks for bringing all that insight to the intricate world of value-based care. I want to talk now more operations-focused. Alternative clinical models like collaborative care, I hear, is touted just really broadly beneficial for providers, payers, and patients. I would love to know your take on alternative models of care. And let's start with just, you know, clinical efficacy, and then later we'll turn to operations. So what's your take on these models?
Great question, Morgan. And I think the industry is thinking more and more and more about these alternative models, and they should be thinking about it because we have hit some sort of a limit in the sense of availability of services versus availability of compared to availability of clinicians, compared to the amount of patients that want to engage in treatment. So we're at a point where we do need to start getting more creative, but I think the ask here is to get creative in a way that you keep the patient in the center of your approach and that you can truly demonstrate that this alternative model is going to continue driving better outcomes for the patient population. So when you talk about MindPath and the way we see alternative models, we believe they are part of the spectrum of care, right? I think they're adding more value and more access to care to people who are likely not going to get the right care or the needed treatment because of many, many reasons. But this is a way of increasing access to care. Quality is the main question here, right? How do we make sure that when we're making them operational or enacting these models or implementing these models, we still are able to prove the quality of the services? If you think overall about the spectrum of care where somebody might get access to services, it is well known that a lot of the patients are getting their first interaction with mental health at the primary care level. And let's maybe refer to that as the overall wellness industry, which is one of the largest industries in healthcare in the US, right? So when you think about that part, the PCP part, the primary care part, then for patients to access mental health, it's normally a referral made from primary care going towards outpatient psychiatry, which is kind of a step above in terms of specialization. And that gap in between is what some of these alternative models are trying to bridge, right? So for example, the collaborative care model, highly studied model that has proved to have great outcomes for the patient population. It is a model that's anchored on the primary care side of the spectrum, but that engages psychiatry to really drive outcomes, meaningful outcomes for the patient, and to also get us kind of a standardized understanding around when is primary care reaching the limit of what they can do, and not necessarily from an intellectual perspective, obviously, but more from a, their day is extremely packed. They have hundreds of patients. When do I make that referral to psychiatry and let that patient continue their treatment pathway into the outpatient psychiatry arena, right? So, and then from there, we can determine if the patient needs a higher level of care or not. But the reality is that a lot of the patients are contained in this primary care side, and these alternative models are going to help us bridge this gap and hopefully achieve great outcomes and get the patients the care that they need. I think overall, MindPath, we see those models fitting in very nicely into the things that we are currently doing. And honestly, Morgan, when I think about it, my goal is to reach patients however they want to be served or however they want to be reached, right? That means that if the patient feels more comfortable engaging in treatment at the PCP, in the PCP space versus in outpatient, we're happy to partner with primary care to engage those patients in treatment and hopefully improve their quality of life. I think you ask about the clinical outcomes. And in terms of that, I believe that a well-implemented model that's anchored or based in measurement-based care with the ability to screen and understand how patients are improving through time is really going to make a big difference for our patient population.
And then in terms of operationalizing these clinical models, how do providers start if they're interested?
I mean, I think it's important to go back to the root of these, the evidence of these types of alternative models. If you go, I mean, there's a lot of research around collaborative care model, around other models that might be enacted in between primary care and the mental health arena. So I think they can be complicated to make operational, but I also think and know that there are plenty of resources available to help understand the framework and how to implement it. Obviously, for these models, Morgan, primary care partnership is essential, right? So if you're a primary care practice that's looking to enact this collaborative care model, whether it is us, MindPath, helping you with the site consultation portion of the model, or if it's another organization doing it, make sure that you do your research and understand how the model is going to turn into an operational model that doesn't take away, but it adds to the patient's probability of getting better, right? I think that's what we all should be working on.
And then whether providers are using alternative models or traditional ones, is there one thing that you think providers right now could be doing to better ensure clinical quality and positive outcomes?
Yeah, I think that, well, multiple things, but I think the first thing that comes to mind is that, and I think I spoke a little bit about it before, is that we continue looking at the things that we do and understand what you're good at and where you're lacking, right? It is important that we often, if not daily, weekly, look at your data set and understand how the trends are moving, how the patients are reporting that they are feeling, how the patients are moving through their treatment pathway, if they are coming back to treatment or not. So I think it is kind of a good time to go back to the very, to a basic approach of understanding our patients. And then that should be the thing that's informing your quality system or your quality checkpoints, right? It is important that you engage in meaningful compliance processes and procedures and understanding what your providers are doing and how they are doing it and drive conclusions around it, and then engage your clinical pool, your clinical talent to really get them to understand what is it that we're looking at and how doing X, Y, or Z could actually improve or increase engagement or improve the health outcomes of the patient population.
Great. And my next question, I think a little bit relates to what we've been talking about, but what is MindPath's approach to partnering with health systems? How do you create relationships with health system partners?
I think if you think about it, and I think this might be true for a lot of us in the mental health space, right? There's a lot of need for outpatient mental health services. And a lot of our patients, whether we like it or not, are going to come directly from a health system, right? So, because they tend to have really large patient populations and they tend to have a need for mental health services. So first of all, I will encourage you to do your research, understand your geography, understand where you're located and who are the main players, and find the right partner, right? Because not everyone is looking for what you can offer. So who is looking for the set of services that you know you're good at and that you can offer, it is important to start with that thought process early on, even before approaching the health systems for a conversation. I think approaching it from a total population health perspective, I've seen and we've noticed that the health systems care a lot about it, right? So how is the patient population behaving? Are they showing up or not? Are they engaging in treatment? Are they coming back for treatment? Are they completing their measurement-based care portions of the treatment plan? Like, all of those things are important, because then you can go to them and show a fuller picture about what's happening with their patients when they come to you. Understand well your referral processes. Understand well what happens when a patient comes to you. What are the steps? Be able to verbalize what happens to a patient when they come to you, to make it a way to make it more appealing for health systems to want to partner with you. Talk about your data sharing capabilities. What is it that you can share with them that will be meaningful for their metrics that they have to comply with in terms, for example, of the 7-day access metrics? Okay, how fast can I get your patient seen? How fast can I get them in with X, Y, or Z type of provider, right? Understand all of that and be able to put a story together that tells you and tells your system partners that you're willing to really be their right arm when it comes to outpatient mental health or behavioral health services. Again, making sure that there is a common area of need, right? Because you're not going to be the right partner for everyone, and that's perfectly fine. But for those that you deem, or that they deem you to be the right partner, then how do I approach it? How do I tailor my services to ensure that your system are getting what you need and that your patients are actually getting seen in an appropriate way? I like to ask them this question, Morgan, point blank. What are you looking for? What are you looking for that you think I can help you solve for? Are you looking for access? Are you looking for measurement? Are you looking for us to partner in a value-based care contract or an alternative payment model? What is your end goal? Are you just looking for more of your members to be seen by a quality outpatient provider? That's perfectly fine. But all of those answers are going to help you engage in the conversation differently and are going to help you shape how the relationship can move forward.
Perfect. And Diego, my last question for you is just turning it back to MindPath. What are your priorities for MindPath for 2025? What can we expect from MindPath this year?
Great question. I think 2025 is going to be an exciting year for MindPath. I think overall, Morgan, as a company, we have always been focused on patients and clinicians. There cannot be one without the other, right? So in 2025, we're excited to continue to work on clinical outcomes, on patient engagement metrics, on clinician satisfaction and clinician retention, and exploring new care models, right? We talked about the alternative care models. How can we explore and get more embedded in that area? That's an area of focus for 2025. So overall, I think we've made a lot of improvements to our platform from a clinical perspective, from a technology perspective, from an operational perspective. And we believe that we are distinct in the marketplace, offering both in-person and online appointments across therapy and psychiatry. And we are growing other lines of services like interventional psychiatry that truly drive really great outcomes for our patient population. And hopefully, we will continue to be an organization that afford our patients and clinicians more options of care. And I think we hope to continue welcoming new clinicians to our practice and to continue being a place where people want to come work and care for patients.
Fantastic. Diego, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to have this conversation. I learned a lot. I really enjoyed it. Just thank you again.
Morgan, I just want to say thank you. I appreciate the invitation, and I appreciate being part of Perspectives, and I appreciate collaborating with you and have for a long time. So thank you for that. Again, thank you, and I hope we can all continue driving meaningful change for this coming year.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Morgan Gonzalez with WTWH Media, Chicago, Illinois.